Geraldine Brooks has honored us with her presence here on the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell has just brought forth an appalling idea that must make the reporter in you crazy, that things that are known to have happened are rejected by these so-called deniers when you come to something as essential to understand as the Inquisition in European history.
It looks a lot like Holocaust denial.
It does. It has a lot in common with that. But the Inquisition wasn't just one thing. It was in many places, as you said, over several centuries. And it was serving different purposes at different times. But the overarching thing was that it was trying to make sure everybody was doing the right groupthink. And I think that the genius of this country was to say, we don't do that. Your religious beliefs are your own and keep them in your private life, and we will have a public sphere that is free of that. And I can't believe that people want to give up this great genius idea of America, one of the bedrock ideas of our foundation that has you know, brought us to such a successful place in the world.
But we're still arguing
about that. By giving
up
the right to keep your religion to yourself and leave everybody else in the public square alone.
Bringing church into the political forum is just a horrible mistake in my view.
We're going to have this discussion again tomorrow with Edward Larson, who's just written a history of the election of 1800. Mm. And it's written by a modern author, so he has the perspectives, a modern perspective, but it is just sort of a carbon copy of where we are today. There were serious establishmentarians in this country. There was an established church. There were established churches in most of the states. Virginia, I mean, part of the objection to Jefferson was that he had written the statute essentially on religious freedom for Virginia, and that made him an atheist, and that was a lot of what the campaign against him was about. This we thought we would resolve this argument, and it's still going on. It's still very alive, and
you give pretty good fact-based experience for why we should make this decision in such a way that gives people freedom rather than, as you so elegantly put it, groupthink.
Or coercion. Mm-hmm.
The People of the Book is a wonderful book, and it takes us lots of places we need to be. And I must say, so did Year of Wonders and March. I'm particularly intrigued by March, not just because you won the Pulitzer for it, but because I think that Louisa May Alcott sort of got put over here as little girl literature, and it's not true. Louisa May Alcott comes from a very important part of the American experience that is both the first and second wave of the Great Awakenings and what really happened within the whole group that is Emerson, Thoreau, and her father, Branson Alcott, who was virtually forgotten until you come back and say, let's look at this again. Again, this is part of being a storyteller. Was it Bronson, I didn't say it correctly, sorry, Alcott, who pulled you to this? Was it Little Women? You credit your mom having said, she's not really that saccharine nice. Nobody. Marmy.
Nobody is such a goody-goody as
goody-goody,
that
goody-goody, that was it. But it seemed to me that you did that wonderful reporter thing in all three of these of saying, yes, and. That's what we understand, and there's more to be said.
It was such a fantastic time to explore. It was such a radical time. People were really, in the 1830s, when Bronson was in his heyday.
Which is Louisa May Alcott's father.
Father. Living in Concord with Emerson across the road and down the way. And, you know, and all the great thinkers of the time coming through. Margaret Fuller and John Brown came and gave a talk. So they were ardent abolitionists, and they were trying to think about a new spirituality and transcendentalism and just reformers in every way, women's rights activists and educational radicals. And they were just a stupendously interesting bunch of people, as was Louisa May Alcott. Unfortunately, one of the things that I discovered during the research was that despite the instant success and financial rewards that Little Women brought to her, and she really was the J.K. Rowling of her day. Mm-hmm. The book was an instant hit. She didn't have much time for it because she felt it was a book she'd written just to satisfy her publishers rather than her own desires as a writer. And she wrote a little line in her journal that just floored me when I read it. She said, "My publisher has asked me for a book for girls. I don't like girls much."
I was one. Well, again, the ability to take fact, and I guess there is a question embedded here, this business that fact and fiction are different seems to me to be wrong.
Oh, no, I would violently disagree. I'm all for the distinction between fact and fiction. And if you write a nonfiction book and it's on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, then everything in it better be true. And I hate this kind of merging where it's become kind of acceptable to change the time frame that things happen, to put yourself in a conversation when you hadn't even come to the city at that point, to do these, what do they call them, composite characters, where you take a bit from this and a bit from that. I'm sorry. It's really hard to write a compelling nonfiction narrative. You have to wear out your shoe leather to be there and put yourself out there and witness and witness and witness, because it doesn't usually come out in a perfect little anecdote until you've really sweat blood. So I think it's really devaluing what true nonfiction writers do. This kind of merging of the two genres.
Well, fortunately, James Frey has helped us.
Before him. A book that I absolutely love, John Berendt's Savannah murder mystery, The Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. When I got to the end of that and he has that disclaimer saying that, you know, this has changed and that's changed, lots of things have changed, but I get closer to the essential truth. I felt like drop-kicking it off the balcony because...
You felt violated by
it. Well, and then I found out that he was putting himself in the room for conversations when one of the parties had been dead and buried before he even came to Savannah. So I don't think that's nonfiction.
Well, and why, you know, there's something about this, you know, it's in the categories. You know, if you call it nonfiction, I think most people would expect everything in there to be the best possible representation of what actually happened. Mm. Now, there's always ambiguity.
Well,
in that,
there is Kurosawa saying what happened from seven different directions.
That's
okay.
Fantastic.
But that's art.
Yeah, but it, you know, there are different interpretations of the same event, but you, the writer, should be giving it your best shot to tell it as it happened and not try and make it end neatly and tie it up in a bow. And you know, many, many writers that I admire have said that they do this. And it really surprised me. And I guess that's the journalistic training coming through, because, you know, you'd be run out of town on a rail if you do it as reporters have been.
Well, I think of John Neidenauer and his colleagues, Wittgenstein's Poker, which to me is just an extraordinary representation of how a room full of brilliant people in a major event, and nobody sees it the same way.
Yeah.
You know, 15 minutes, it's not as if this was an extended event.
Yeah.
You know, no motion or very little motion, except, of course, the poker. and people could not agree on it. But that is substantially, dramatically different from changing time sequences, from changing characters, from putting people together who were not there together.
I am thrilled to be standing corrected. Now, can I do
sitting
that?
Corrected.
May I do that another way?
Would you like to try that again?
I would like to try that again. Fiction has so much truth.
Oh, yes.
That includes some things that are fact. And on the fiction side, it's not like it's make-believe for it to be fiction. Am I better?
Well, part of this is a degenerate notion of what truth is.
Yes.
We tend to think of truth and facts as identical, and that's something that...
Exactly.
...not the case.
There was that movie, Actual Malice, that said something can be accurate but not true. And I think that is absolutely the case. I think about when we took an assignment in the Middle East and they described the apartment that we would be living in as being on an island in the Nile with a view of the pyramids and three bathrooms. And all of that was accurate, but none of it was really true.
Well, somebody had a room that had some pieces like that somewhere, but It wasn't yours.
There was a view of the pyramids in principle, but if you've been in Cairo, the dust is so thick you can't see it. And of the three bathrooms, you were lucky if one of them had a working toilet at any given time.
It wasn't occupied. Well, I guess that the thrill of your ability to give us fact-enriched stories that have truth in them, when you are in fact writing, triple entendre, writing fiction, there are lots of ways to get to the truth. And it would seem to me that having experience being a world-class journalist for a big, worldwide, admired editorial paper, did I say that rightly? The reporting of the Wall Street Journal is widely and highly regarded.
Yeah, it's confusing to talk about editorial content.
Yes, I have to be careful when I do that. The mix of that, I would think, would be very inspiring to young writers.
Well, I hope. Yeah. So, the more the merrier. I'm always trying to encourage young people to write about their experiences and then about their imagined worlds. And, I actually think J.K. Rowling deserves to be given, the highest honors in the land for what she's done, reintroducing kids to the big fat book and the pleasures thereof.
There was a recent article in the New Yorker about what they, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but essentially the re-oralization of art, that people are reading less, particularly with respect to television. And the perspective, I can't remember the book they were referencing, but it's the perspective is essentially a psychological perspective that we really are, we experience the world radically different as literate people than we do as oral people.
We experience it differently. And it is a different world we experience.
The argument, and I think this is all very preliminary research, or at least thinking about it, I'm not sure that even the research, is that we, that oral cultures tend to be, tend to accept reality as it is presented and are less questioning.
Than literate ones.
Than literate cultures, which is both an interesting concept. It may not be true. The research to me is very thin, but it brings up some interesting challenges as we diminish our contact with real literature.
Written literature, as opposed to that that's done orally. You have to think about that while we take a quick break, and then we'll be right back, please, with Geraldine Brooks. Be with us.